We're doing Parshat Nitzavim. Our parsha brings us to a point which very often we miss. We can very often make comments, give rebuke, criticism, and the question is, do we know the follow-up to criticism? The pasuk says in Mishlei, "Ki et asher yahav Hashem yochiach." Hashem rebukes those he loves. Ucha'av et ben yirtzeh. And just as a father, after he rebukes his son, he makes it up to him. He gives him more. He brings him closer. We know Chazal tell us there is a concept of smol docha v'min mekarevet. You use your left hand to distance. You use your right hand to bring close. When we educate, when we develop relationships, we have to have both. You always have to have both. A relationship isn't only about hugging. A relationship is also about setting boundaries. This is right, and this is not right, and this I'm happy to do, and this I'm not willing to do. There's healthiness in a relationship. People say, we're married, so I can do anything. Who said you can do anything? What does that mean? I can throw a plate at you. Why can you throw a plate at me? There are limits. There are things that shouldn't happen. We're married, but that doesn't mean there aren't limits. You love your child, and yet there are things which you expect of the child and demand of the child. But, Chazal said, the stronger hand has to bring close. And Chazal tell us that in our history, we have tragic instances where people were not careful to use the more powerful hand to bring the person close. So the first one was Avraham Avinu. There was a lady called Timna who desperately wanted to become a part of Avraham's family. And she wanted to, and Avraham didn't see it fit. And so she went and married Eliphaz, Avraham's grandson. And from that came Amalek. And Chazal fault Avraham. In the pasuk, we don't see an indication of any of this. But Chazal fault Avraham. Chazal say, you pushed her away too hard. You should have brought her close. And so from that came all of Amalek. Chazal tell us the same story happened with Yeshu. He spoke inappropriately. He was looking at a woman's beauty. His rabbi was upset at him. What are you doing looking at the beauty of our hostess? And so his rabbi said, gave him the indication, get out of here. But he didn't mean forever. And the student wasn't clear enough that his rabbi wanted him back. So ultimately he became what we know, Yeshu. So Chazal warned us, there has to be that balance, and the stronger hand must be bringing close. And if I have to rebuke or criticize someone, it has to be that afterwards the person feels even closer to me. That I've been able to show him that I love him more than I showed him beforehand. Moshe Rabbeinu gave us this whole long speech about the threats of what could happen if we misbehave. So he has to give us a pep talk after that. He has to bring us back, strengthen us. How do I deal with that? He begins, Atem nitzavim hayom. You're all standing here today. You've made it. And Hashem has established you here. You've been given the standing. And they look at you. You have leaders, you're divided into tribes, you have policemen, you have children, you have wives, you even have nations that have come in that they want to join the Jewish people, and that they've been appointed as woodcutters and water drawers. Everyone's here. Hashem is making a covenant with you. And not only you, but also future generations. Hashem is making a deal that you're responsible to live up to the Torah, and Hashem is going to be with you. Moshe Rabbeinu says, I'm also making the pact with future generations, the future generations that were not yet born. So that's an interesting concept. How do I get into a deal that obligates my kids? Who asked them? So I could lock them in. There is this concept. You could. Chazal tell us that even the gerim are included. That's what we discussed once, that the idea that a person has free will, whether to convert or not convert, that's an interesting concept, because Chazal tell us that once he converts, then we say retroactively, you know, your soul was there at Sinai. You were given a soul that already at the receipt of Torah was standing there saying, I want a part of this. So do we have free will? So in this we're going to have to say a little bit of circular reasoning, that if a person converts, then we know retroactively a soul was there. If he doesn't convert, then I guess his soul wasn't there. So you'll say, how do I know? We'll say, we'll see. Time will tell, yes or no. We've had students here who left the GEAR program even in this past year. People came, they were interested, they tried, and they said, wait a second, not for me. And we respect them.
We don't say, wow.
You say nothing negative. That's fine. So we have this concept that the souls were there. So Moshe says, the pact is, you've seen a lot of things. And it could be that deep down a person says to himself, maybe it's a good idea. You know, when they left Egypt, they had slithers of gold that had the tetragrammaton on one side, Yud Kei Vav Kei, God's hidden name. And on the other side, they had the shape of a calf, a golden calf. Because in Egypt, they worshipped the calf, so this is what they took out with them. So Moshe says, it could be that there's someone who's thinking to himself, I'm going to be okay, because when you water the garden, everyone gets water together. You don't choose this plant will get water and that plant won't. You water a whole garden. I'll be with the Jewish people. They'll get their blessing. I'll benefit from that too, but in my privacy, I'll do my own thing. And here the Ribbono Shel Olam tells us there's responsibility. We cannot ignore what goes on around us. Hashem says, I will personally take a person to task, and I will not let a person get away with it. But Hashem says, but you, the Jewish people, also have mutual responsibility. That's the concept called Yisrael Arevim Ze Bazeh. We're all co-signers on one another. We all co-signed on one another's pact. Now, where does this have relevance? Okay, you're going to get up Friday night. You come home, you make kiddush. Good for you. You did kiddush. You did your mitzvah? Yes or no? The answer is both, yes and no. You did your mitzvah, you did kiddush, but your neighbor didn't. So you didn't finish your mitzvah. I have responsibility for him. Where does this come up? So, comes up, Ezrat Hashem, you'll be in the hospital, your wife will give birth, you'll be there Friday night, you'll make Kiddush for her, and then after you make Kiddush, you'll see that a new woman gets wheeled into the ward, and she didn't hear Kiddush yet. And she might say, hey, did you make Kiddush yet? Can you make Kiddush for me? So you'll think, I just made for my wife, how can I make for you? The answer, I have a responsibility to her as well. If we read Megillah, right? We read we blow shofar. I finished my shofar blowing. A guy walks in, he says, I just got off my shift. Who could blow shofar for me? So I say, sorry, Charlie, I already did my mitzvah. How could I blow for you? You want me to make blessings? I did my blessings already. Not true, I didn't finish my mitzvah. If he didn't hear shofar, I didn't finish my mitzvah. And I can make the blessing for him and blow shofar again all over for him. See, that's the responsibility we have. Yes? In halacha, all over. Hilchot Kiddush, sure, it's in the Gemara. Sure. It's in Psachim, it's in Brachos, it's in Rosh Hashanah, it's all over. Okay, so we discussed earlier tonight, Hashem discusses that the people could be punished and banished from the land just as the sun sets. And we said there's a machloket tanaim about whether that's a positive or a negative. Does it mean just as the sun sets and today will never come back, so too the 10 tribes will be lost and will never return? Or does it mean that just as the sun sets and rises again tomorrow, so too when the 10 tribes are lost, they're still coming back? And that leads us to a broader discussion. What happened to the 10 tribes? Did they intermarry? Did they get killed? Did they get banished beyond a river called Sambatyon? So whenever we take a Jewish word and we make it Greek, so many, many Jewish words have the word yon at the end. So Shabbat becomes Shabbat yon. This river, there is an opinion that they were taken over this river. What's this river? This is a river that shoots out rocks all week long. It's a volcanic river, and all the time rocks are shooting out of it. On Shabbos, it doesn't shoot out rocks. So the Talmud says that Turnus Rappus once asked Rabbi Akiva, he says, so many years have passed, how do you know you're keeping Shabbos on the right day? Maybe you lost the day in the exile. How do you know you got it right? Now that sounds far-fetched, right? So, I have a friend who was imprisoned last week. So when he got out, I called him up. Is everything okay, etc.? I said to him, you know, I tried calling you. There was no way to call. I tried to see if I could come in and visit you. They didn't let me in. They said, you're not entitled to visits. Well, He said to me, it's pretty amazing. They take you into a cell. They take away your cell phone. They take away your watch. He said to me, I had no way of knowing. I said, you know, you're not a criminal. I was in shock that they do this. Someone made an allegation against him. The police decided to believe it. They threw him in prison for 4 days. No watch. He told me I couldn't know if it was day or night. They don't tell you how much time has passed. You're sitting there in a different planet. You don't have your watch. No one has a watch. You're in a cell. You don't know if a day passed, a day didn't pass. Now, this isn't solitary confinement. This is a guy who was awaiting a court case. So he's not yet found guilty. But could you imagine living 4 days without a watch and not seeing whether the sun rose or the sun set? So do you know what day of the week it is? Can you know if Shabbos is almost in? I was panicked because on Friday they said they'd let him out at 10 in the morning, and then at 10 they said at 12, and at 12 they said at 2, and at 2 they said at 4. Now, I still don't know if he got out for Shabbos or not. I only spoke to him on Sunday. I didn't want to ask. Figured it's too painful. If not, I won't ask. But we hear about the Jewish people. The Jewish people were on the run. Did they really keep track of the days? This past week I read, you guys know the book Shmirat Shabbat Kehilchata. Rabbi Neuwirth, Rabbi Neuwirth wrote a book, The Laws of Shabbos. So for the first time I read his introduction. He writes there that they were in Holland and things got really bad. And he has a whole fascinating story of how his family ended up in a house that they thought was abandoned. And the underground, the Jews in the underground said to their general, you guys have a Christian pastor, we need a rabbi. And they convinced them that they need a rabbi. So the underground said, they appointed his father as their rabbi. And every week they'd bring them food to the door. So they were in this apartment that no one, the Germans thought it was a desolate apartment. They thought it was an abandoned apartment. He said for 3 years, they never went next to the window. No one should see that someone was living in the apartment. For 3 years, they lived in this apartment. He said he learned whatever books he had with his father. They spent the Holocaust in an apartment that the Germans were sure was abandoned. So he has amazing stories. He says one time they divided the block. Soldiers went up the block checking every house, and soldiers went down the block checking every house. And his father sat there learning, and they thought they were finished. And a miracle happened. The soldiers who went north assumed that the soldiers who went south checked their house, which was the middle house. The soldiers that went south assumed that the soldiers that went north checked that house, and no one went into that middle house. Every other house got checked except for their house. Amazing stories. He writes in the introduction to the book of how they managed. He said they could look out the window, but they couldn't go near the window where they could be seen. So they, for 3 years, they spent in a house, never walking out of the house. How did they keep track of the days? So I guess there it's easier, right? They could still see the sunrise and sunset, right? But that's what Turnus Ruffus asked Rabbi Akiva. He says, how do you know you didn't lose track of the days? So Rabbi Akiva gives him a few answers. He says, first of all, check your father's grave. You'll see that your father, who was a wicked person, every day of the week there's smoke coming out of his grave because he's being burnt in hell. But on Shabbos it rests. So he went and checked his father's grave, and he saw it. And then he said to him, if you go check this river, Sambatyon, you'll see 6 days a week that the river's shooting up rocks. On Shabbat, it doesn't shoot up rocks. So again, it sounds like there was, or maybe still is, this amazing river, a volcanic river. And that's the third opinion, that the 10 tribes were taken to the other side of that volcanic river. No one was here Shavuos time, right? None of you guys were here from Shavuos. You were here from Shavuos. So you remember the story of Akdamos, right? So we on Shavuos we learned the whole story. There's, I guess we would call it folklore. In Jewish folklore, there's a story about a man who crossed over Sambatyon to bring over someone from the other side, to bring over a Jew from the lost 10 tribes. So we have three opinions. We move forward. We're up to Revi. We are up to Revi. So we are responsible for one another when it comes to mitzvot that we can see. This is a big theme in the book of Devarim. There's a big temptation in life to say, live and let live. Why should I make a ruckus? I'm going to go fight my neighbor? So what if my neighbor is doing things that are wrong? Is it my problem? Why should I make a big deal out of it? And the Torah repeatedly warns us in the book of Devarim, that you're going into the land of Israel. It is your land. You have to care. There was a big rabbi in Bnei Brak who was told that in his neighborhood, there was one block that the trees made it dark on the block and drug dealers were coming to the block. So he went to that block and he said, he asked them to leave. And they laughed at him. And he said, you guys can't be here. You cannot deal drugs over here. And they wouldn't listen to him. So he came one day and he brought a ladder and an axe, and he started hacking down all the branches of the trees there so that the street lights would make light again and they wouldn't want to do drugs there. So the police caught him and they gave him this big fine and they gave him a court date. So he comes to court and the judge sees an old rabbi from Bnei Brak. He's not too impressed, and he says to him, I hear you were cutting down public trees. So the rabbi says, can I first tell you a story? He says, yes. He says, imagine that you're walking down the street one evening and you see someone climbing into a building. He's climbing, he's scaling, he's brought a ladder and he's climbing up a building to climb into the window. What would you say? So the judge says, I'd say you have to call the police, the guy's a thief. So the rabbi says, so let me tell you, I'm that person. I've already had once that I brought a ladder to a building and I was climbing up and I climbed in through the window. The judge says, and why'd you do that? He said, I heard there were children in distress in the house, that their parents had left them, and something had happened in the house, and I heard the kids yelling from the window, can someone come save them? I ran home, brought my ladder, climbed up and climbed in through the window. So he sees this old rabbi with this long black coat, and he says, I'm the guy who climbed up that window. So the judge says, what do you want to say by that? He says, what I want to say is, don't judge a story by its appearances. You already thought I was a thief because I was climbing up when I didn't do something so bad. He says, so now you're telling me I did something inappropriate by cutting down public trees? Well, I asked the dealers and I asked the police and I went to the municipality and I said, we have drugs over here. You guys have to stop it. And no one was willing to do the job. So I risked myself versus the drug dealers and I went to cut down the branches. And I did it for the public good. I don't live on that block, but I care for the public good. And the judge respected it and let him off without a fine. So this idea that we have responsibility is one of the recurring themes in the book of Devarim. You're living in your own country. You're in Eretz Yisrael. You're living in your community. You have a responsibility. You can't just say, it's not my problem what they're doing on the other block. I live here and I'm okay. Why is that my problem? No, it is your problem. And this is a theme that we have to take into us. It's people often are tempted to misapply it. People want to give a donation to the Red Cross in Uganda. Might be a good idea, but did you take care of your neighbor down the block? Before you're thinking about the people all over the world, what about the people here? What about people here who aren't getting the attention they need? We have a responsibility internally, and there are people who don't get the attention they need. And that can be people who don't make it to the hospital. That can be people who are aged and they don't have adequate heating in their home. You know how many people die of cold? Old people in Israel because they don't have adequate heat every winter? There are big problems here. I mean, we have to deal. Comes the Torah and reiterates the warning over and over and over again. You cannot say, live and let live. Now that's challenging. Because very often you say, if I'm going to say something, I'll make problems. So it takes a certain understanding to get it right. You can do this in a way that you're always fighting people. I told my kids this true example this past Shabbos. There was a guy who he told me the story about himself. He came to a shul and the guy behind him was talking and he asked the guy to please be quiet. And the next Shabbos, same deal. And by the third Shabbos, he gets up and he starts yelling at the guy, I asked you to be quiet. This is a shul. Why can't you be quiet? You're destroying. Everyone's davening. And he's yelling and yelling and yelling. And the whole shul looks at him like, buddy, okay, so your neighbor was talking. What are you doing? He got so embarrassed. He left the shul, didn't come back again. The only problem is the same thing happened in the second and the third shul he went to. Every shul he goes to, he discovers that the guy next to him isn't quiet enough. So now we ask a question. Are all the people in the shuls inappropriate, or is he inappropriate, or both? He'll tell you that three shuls and I couldn't find a seat where people weren't talking. And we'll say, with all due respect, buddy, there's a way to deal with that problem, and you don't have the right way. So the Torah tells us we have responsibility. Here the wisdom is to figure out, A, to begin by taking responsibility. I am responsible for what happens in my neighborhood. And B, to do it smartly. So 4 weeks ago, I get a phone call. It's the new rabbi of Kochel Yaakov. He tells me, across the street from you, someone just dumped a bunch of boxes, and the dump is overflowed down into the street, and it's endangering the passersby. I said, okay. I went outside. I started collecting all the garbage, put it in the bin. He comes over to me a half hour later. He says, I didn't mean for you to do it. I meant, do you know who's going to take care of it? I'm going to go look, and I have no idea who's going to take care of it. You told me this problem. I came and dealt with it. So he told me that before he was rabbi of Kochav Yaakov, he would walk to shul with the bag. Because on his way to shul, what happens? People take their garbage to throw out Friday afternoon. They send the kids, and things fall along the way. Why should the community look dirty on Shabbos? He would walk to shul with a garbage bag, collecting people's garbage on his way to shul. So that's Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach would be going to yeshiva, and he'd see the women sometimes carrying, they had kerosene heaters, carrying the big jerrycans of fuel to heat up their homes. And he'd take it from them and carry it up to their house, because he said, how could it be a daughter of Israel's carrying such a heavy load up their house? There's this concept, I'm responsible. I can't just walk away and say it's someone else's problem. It's my problem. This is my people. This is my country. I have to care. And I can easily say, what do I need all these problems for? It's not my problem. It is my problem. We move forward. So that's a recurring theme which is brought to the peak in our parasha, where the Ribbono Shel Olam says, what you don't know, you're not responsible for. What you do know, you are responsible for. Again, you have to do it intelligently. You have to do it responsibly. But you do have to deal. Rapta Ravi. Hashem tells us, wherever you are, do tshuva. Things aren't going right. I warned you in last week's parasha that things can go wrong. Hashem says, so wherever you are, do tshuva. And this brings us to the Hasidic concept, which is so important, the idea of the pintaleyit. That every person deep down inside has some spark, that even if everything else is gone, that spark is still there. And sometimes a person is left so down that the only thing they can believe in is that. But you have that. What we call the pintaleyid, the idea that there's a spark that's left in everyone, and a person has to ignite that spark. Yes?
So we have like our own responsibility for ourselves, but also as a community, as a society, we have a responsibility that everybody's okay. Because I thought about it, like, if you read the English translation, it says you, but it's impure, so it means like you impure, so it's not directed you, it's directed at God. And that can maybe explain why bad things can happen to Sadiqim, because they more or less did everything right. But it must mean that the Klal is not there.
I didn't want to go into that because it's not so relevant to us, but yes, there is that theme as well. Yeah. Yeah, Hashem describes, you'll do tshuva, and I will return with you. So that's another recurring theme in all of Tanakh and in Chazal, that Hashem says, when you're exiled, I go with you. I'm not just sending you out there alone. We're moving forward. It says, "Umal Hashem lokechet levavcha ve'et levav zarecha." Hashem will circumcise your heart, and your children's heart. So that's another important theme. I have difficult news for you guys. Why does the Torah have to promise us you and your children? Because the nature of the world is that if you did tshuva, then your children will want to rebel the other direction. And a child says, you swung the pendulum this way, you went away from what your parents did, I'm going to swing it the other way. Why not? You rebelled against what your parents did, right? You chose a more religious path, so I can go the other way. That is an ongoing challenge for Chozer B'tshuva and the Ger. There is this recurring challenge that the children have a great temptation to go in the opposite direction. What are some things we can do about this? So, number one, we can try to lead a balanced home. It's a very hard thing for a chozer b'tshuva or a ger. Why? Because anyone who's undergone that process is someone who is open to change and is interested in embracing what's right and is willing to fluctuate. You don't make such a change in your life like chazara b'tshuva or giyur without a tremendous drive for getting what's right and a tremendous ability, capacity to change. You're changing your whole life, right? So you have to, so then that also means that a person can continue fluctuating though. And that is very difficult for children. Children need consistency. I had a friend growing up whose parents were chozrim b'tshuva, and he told us once in class. He said, my father has periods. He comes home and he says, television is terrible. He takes a hammer, breaks the television, throws it out the door. Then a year later, he calms down. He says, I'm bringing home a television just to watch the news. I got to be on top of the news. Half a year later, we're all watching movies. And a half a year later, my father comes back and says, tshuva, tzelo, bam, the television goes out. And their whole life was this fluctuation, up and down and up and down. Now, if you're a private person, you can fluctuate. You know, that can happen. Good for the economy, yeah. But as a parent, you're running a home. Better you choose a path you can be consistent on and grow slowly, but be consistent. Kids need consistency. Second challenge is, can kids integrate? Or are kids always the weird ones? Because very often, chozer b'tshuva has no compunctions about being different than everyone else, because you have to be different in order to make this process, right? So then everyone else goes to shul, he goes to kippah shruga shul. We had a student who did this, and he wears a bekesha, and he wears a Hasidic hat, and he's in a southern town where it's broiling hot, and a very tall fellow, and he... all eyes are on him. He walks into shul. Everyone else is wearing kippah shruga. He's from Machon Meir. Under his shtreimel, he has a kippah shruga. But so his wife says, what are you doing? He says, this is how I feel Shabbos. She says, no one else does this. He says, I feel holy like this. This is my Shabbos. I'm not asking you to shave your head. I'm telling you, this is what I'm doing over Shabbos. Okay. So long as there aren't kids, you want to be in your own world, so the rest of the world looks at you. That's a questionable whether it's a good idea. You have kids, so then kids say, wait, I want to fit in. Ah, anything goes. I can be different than anyone else. I'll choose how to be different. There are other ways to be different. I'll choose where to be different. So there's a chozer b'tshuva and a ger by nature is a nonconformist. And that's a strength. But there comes a point where not only being balanced and consistent, there's also finding a community and fitting in. So that your kids feel like, I'm a part of this. I want to continue this. And then there's a third point, and that is the question of relationships with parents. If a parent shows up and they're spending the week by you, and they're going to wear their necklace with a cross, so then your kid gets a little bit confused. You know, what's going on here? We had a guy who... told his parents that on the yeshuv they don't allow Christian paraphernalia. So he made up with the guard at the entrance to the yeshuv, and he said to the parents, you know, we'll prepare you a bag, and all your Christian stuff you'll put in a bag at the gate, and you'll pick it up when you leave, because we're not allowed to bring it into the yeshuv. So they believed him. They said, fine. They prepared all their stuff there, and they left it with the guard. So that was a way to make sure it didn't come home. If you confuse the kids, I had a friend who... still have a friend whose father was a very frivolous dude. He rode a motorcycle, and he'd have a different girlfriend every few weeks. So the kids see he comes to them for the Shabbos meal. So the tattoos is one issue. But if he shows up every few months with a new girlfriend, what are the kids supposed to understand from that? You know, this is Saba, and that's Saba's girlfriend. Oh, so we're okay to have girlfriends. What are they supposed to understand? So here it takes a certain skill to know how to balance the relationship with the parents. On the one hand, we're going to be respectful. On the other hand, do we have to expose our kids to the whole world we grew up in? Because if we do, then we're giving them a challenge, because in their mind, like one student here at Mahon Meir told me, his parents were actually fully observant. They were chozrim b'tshuva. But he said he had a very hard time, because his whole life, he saw his parents, he saw his grandparents, and he always felt like he has two options. He could be like Abba and Ima, where on Shabbos the TV's off. He could be like Saba and Safta, where Shabbos was okay to turn on the TV and watch his cartoons. So he'd go visit his grandparents for Shabbos, and there anything went. So that's a challenge. How do you bring up kids so that where you have to decide? And here I recommend you have a Rebbe who you can consult with, someone who has experience to figure out how to maintain that balance. There are many tricks to the trade, but we can't cover all of them here. So we came to this discussion because the promise here is umalet levavcha vet levav zarecha. Hashem says there will be a time where you will do tshuva and your kids will stick to the tshuva. And Hashem is giving us an indication that ordinarily that's not such an easy thing for you and your kids to stick on the path. What do we say? What are the three hardships? He said number one, consistency. Number two, conformity. Do I match my surroundings? And number three, the parents. Okay, those are three major challenges. We move forward. I told you guys the story about the dragon tablecloth. Yeah, a guy once invited me to his house, and he shows me their tablecloth, and I see this dragon like this. So I asked him, what is that? He says, it's a Shabbos tablecloth. I said, looks like a Purim tablecloth. He says, you kidding? Right. He says, I was in China. He says, I paid thousands of dollars for that. That's hand embroidered. You know how expensive that tablecloth is? I'm honoring Shabbos. I bought it lichvot in honor of Shabbos. He said, I said, you know, that's very nice, but your kids need a white tablecloth in honor of Shabbos. All their friends, all the Jewish people, we have a white tablecloth in honor of Shabbos. That's what they need. The Shabbos table has to look traditional. So he says to me, where in Shulchan Aruch does it say a white tablecloth for Shabbos? Okay, doesn't say it in Shulchan Aruch. Fine. So that means I don't have to be like everyone else. That's the atmosphere that every Jewish home has for Shabbos. And I say, where in Shulchan Aruch does it say that? That's not the argument. Your kids want to grow up like everyone else, and there's a certain atmosphere. So then he takes me to another table. He says, this is the special Shabbos table. He has this little table on the floor. I say, what are you doing? That's like for the Seder? You want to commemorate sitting on lying on your side? What does that mean, the special Shabbos table? He says, when Shabbos Rosh Chodesh, when we have a special Shabbos, we sit on the floor, we do Chinese. So we all sit on the floor, and where we sit around this little table here, it's a special Shabbos. Okay. So the kids are growing up weird. None of their friends have a special Shabbos table, right? So what? You have to give them normalcy. Give them a normal upbringing, normal songs at the Shabbos table, normal Shabbos experience. So we move forward. We have the mitzvah of tshuva. We have in Shishi, the Torah says, HaMitzvah hazot asher anochi mitzavecha hayom, the mitzvos I'm commanding you today, lo nifleti mimecha. It's not beyond your capacity. That's a very important theme. You can do it. You can do it. You guys know the story of Rabbi Gifter, right? No. Yeshiva University, 100 years ago. Okay? Yeshiva University's high school, MTA. 100 years ago. The Rebbe walks in, and he says, guys, there's a new student coming out from the far west. He doesn't know too much. Please be nice to him. His name is Max. Okay? They're in the middle of ninth grade. Max comes in. He has a southern accent. And they're nice to him, but he's really the bottom of the class. And one day, one of his friends goes by his room, and he sees over his bed pictures of Talmidei Chachamim. And in the middle, there's a note that says, why not me? Right? Pictures of the great sages of Israel, and in the middle a note that says, why not me, over his bed. So his friend says to him, Max, you know, I don't want to hurt your feelings, but you're not exactly the top of the class. He was beneath the bottom of the class, right? He says, that's what you think? So Max says, yeah, that's what I think. Why not me? Why shouldn't I be up there? Well, Max became the great Rabbi Mordechai Gifter, the Rosh Hashiva of Telz, who was known for not only his wit and his brilliance, but also his oratory skills. The colleges around Cleveland, around Telz Cleveland, used to call him in to give classes. A brilliant mind, started out in ninth grade less than the lowest guy. Okay, but his goal was, why not me? Torah says, lo nifleti mimcha. It's not beyond you. It's not beyond you. Lo nifleti mimcha. Ve'lo rechokai. The Torah is not up in heaven. The Torah is not across the sea. Ki karov elecha hadavar. The Torah is so close to you. Oh, so here we have many concepts. Ki karov. The Torah is close to you. Everyone who's converted will tell you, or at least tell me, that when they discovered Torah, suddenly they found something that seemed natural. It fit. If you grow up with it, you don't see it. Karov elecha. Number two, the Torah is something which is accessible to everyone. You can't tell a person, your father wasn't a Talmud Chacham, who are you to learn? So what? Torah is available to everyone. Free. Here, Machon Meir, look, you could learn for free. We have Arutz Meir, thousands of classes online for free. It's available. No one can withhold Torah. There was once a rabbi who was traveling, he met a Jew, they sat down under the tree, they break bread together. At some point, the rabbi got frustrated with the Jew, so the Jew asked him, Malach, he said, I'm not telling you. The story is quoted in the Zohar, it's a famous story. So the Jew says to him, you thief! So the rabbi says, why am I a thief? What did I take from you? So the Jew says to him, the Torah is called Morasha Kilat Yaakov, the inheritance of all of Yaakov. You know Torah and you're not teaching me, so you're a thief. It's mine just like it's yours. You have no right to withhold it from me. Karov elecha davar mod. The Torah says, I'm available to everyone. You have to work at it. Beficha uvilvavcha. Here we have the concept of the oral law and the written law. Beficha uvilvavcha. The Torah is also in your mouth. The Torah isn't just what's written. There's the oral law that's passed along also. But here we have another concept. The Torah says, you won't find it across the sea. So Chazal say, what does that mean? People have these fantasies. I'll be a big businessman and a big Talmud Chacham. Torah says, no. If you're busy doing business, there are only 24 hours in the day. You're not going to be able to be a big Talmud Chacham. You have to forgo something. You can't deal on every front and learn Torah. Torah requires dedication, a concentration, and a lot of time. So those people who are busy doing business, they're getting all the cheap merchandise overseas. They might make money, but they're not going to make Torah. With Torah, you have to be able to dedicate a lot of time to grow in Torah. We're at the end of the parsha, we're at Shvi. Hashem says, I've given you today life and that which is good, and death and that which is evil, and I command you to love Hashem, go on His path. I want you to choose life. I'm telling you, choose life. Uvaharta b'chayim. So my father has a line on this. My father says, you see, the Torah had to command you, choose life. That means man has a tendency within him to choose death. Man is like a moth. There are times that man is very attracted to the fire. Sometimes a person will be dating a girl and deep down inside he knows this is bad for me, but he's attracted to it. A man will sometimes speed. He's going to go racing and he knows deep down inside a little voice says, this is dangerous. You're risking everything for what? For a thrill of 10 seconds? But man is man has this thrill of playing with death. Uvacharta b'chayim. Torah says, choose life. So that's number one. Number two, this is the pivotal pasuk about free will. Here the Torah says you have free will, because the Torah says you have the choice in front of you. And that's a phenomenal concept which we don't understand. We have free will. How could I have free will? Why do I have free will? God knows everything, and if He wants something, so then why doesn't He do it? So there we have the concept of tzimtzum. Hashem says, I'm going to minimize myself to make room for you. Because technically I'm all-encompassing, but you will have room, and in that you will be godlike. You have a choice. You can choose life, and you can choose something else. And I don't remember who said this. We very often are faced with choices where we're confused. What's the right choice? So every choice can be distilled to this question. Am I choosing life? Am I going to get closer to God or further from God? Every question can be boiled down to that one question. Is my choice bringing me closer to Hashem or more distant? That's all. I want to diverge for 1 second. There's another important concept here. How is it that people lose a whole day, a whole week, a whole month, a whole year, and sometimes a whole lifetime without accomplishing many of their dreams? take an hour. We're going to end class, Be'ezrat Hashem, in 18 minutes. And some people will go straight to bed and others won't. So let's say you're going to stay up for an hour. What are the odds that in that hour you will accomplish what you would like to accomplish? And why don't we? How come we spend much of life not accomplishing what we would like? So the rule is, do we have a plan? If you start your day with a plan, with a to-do list, even if you have 10 minutes, if you write a to-do list, you'll use them right. You sit down in front of the computer. What did you sit down for? Why did you turn that machine on? Do you know? So your mind goes wandering and there's an interesting link and you got an email and you're just checking the news and before you know it, 3 hours have passed and you've done nothing. Why? There was no plan. Just going to wander aimlessly, and today it's very easy to waste time with that. So whenever we have a block of time, if we make a plan, that's what helps us chart our course so that we utilize it correctly. Now that's true about the year. However much time you plan on being in Machon Meir now, what do you want to accomplish? Do you know or don't you? You might not yet know. Could be any time before you know, but can you set goals? I want to understand the biography of Jewish history. Let me read some Jewish history and understand the biographies of Rashi, Rambam. If you set goals, then suddenly in your free time, you'll fill it. I used to have a Seder. For Friday afternoon, when we'd finish class here, I would go to the Makolet to buy challah for Shabbos. So I'd have 5 minutes in line. There was always a line Friday, right? Everyone's buying food for Shabbos. So I had a set Seder. Those 5 minutes I'm online at the Makolet, I learned one book, and the book, Psikta Rav Kahana, that medrash, that was the only time in the week that I'd learn that book. So if I'd show up and there was a short line, I'd be like, oh, shucks, I'm not going to get any learning done today, right? If there was a long line, great, I'm going to finish a lot of the book, right? But that's because it's defined. I have a game plan. I know on that line, this is what I accomplish. I used to wait for the ride here, right here where you have the kioskim. So every morning I'd wait there. I looked over my day. I try to do this every month or two. I look over my schedule, my daily schedule, to see, am I using my time correctly? And I realized that I don't have set learning for that time. That time that I'm waiting for the ride, which is sometimes a minute, sometimes five, I don't have anything set what I learned there. I started learning Tanakh. You start accomplishing book after book. Once things are defined, you can accomplish. You know, I did Daf Yomi. I don't know how many Masechtot on the bus because I defined this time is for that learning. It's defined. Obviously, you have to match it with the focus you can have. Then you can cover things. So this is true for our lives as well. We say choose life. Okay, choose accomplishment. Okay, what does that mean? That means I have to define my times. Well, you know when I started learning in Machon Meir? My first learning in Machon Meir was 13 years ago. 14 years ago. No, learning. I used to learn in Merkaz Harav, and we lived down there on Herzl. And at 6:30, technically, I'd leave Merkaz Harav, and I'd come home. And I discovered that sometimes my wife would come home 10 minutes after me, and sometimes 20 minutes after me, depending on her buses. I said, what do I have to come home? And I have nothing defined what I'm supposed to be doing. We're newlyweds. So I'd leave yeshiva, stop in at Machon Meir. Those were the pre-cell phone days, right? We didn't have cell phones. Come into Machon Meir. I defined for myself, I want to learn one page of Talmud before I go home. After yeshiva, before I come home, you define something, you get to accomplish. I learned all of Tractate Rosh Hashanah at least once, if not twice. Here, Machon Meir, just on that en route. Back in, every time I'd come home, stop here for 20 minutes. There used to be a library down there. You guys didn't see that. That's 13 years ago. You learn. Choosing life doesn't just happen. If we let time go, time will go and we won't accomplish. You want to choose it, you have to decide, what do I want to do with it? And that goes to what I often say, make yourself a plan. Where do you want to be in 20 years? Ask yourself. Write it down. After you finish that, ask yourself, where do I want to be in 10 years? And write that down. Then ask yourself, where do I want to be in 5 years? And write that down in this order. 20, 10, 5, 3. And then ask yourself, where am I headed in 6 months? Does it match my plan for 20, 10, and 5? If we make a plan, we're going to get places. And this is true of small amounts of time and large amounts of times. The key here is charting a path. We end the parsha. Hashem says, I want you to connect to me. How do you connect to Hashem? How do you connect to Hashem? So Chazal said, connect to Talmidei Chachamim. If you connect to Talmidei Chachamim, that's a way of connecting to Hashem. And there are ample opportunities. I can tell you, I used to go to weddings, and when a big rabbi would come to the wedding, I'd ask him for a ride back. I remember one rabbi, I took a ride back with him to Rehovot. We're entering Rehovot, and I ask him, where's the central bus station? He says, where's your next stop? I say, Jerusalem. He says, what? Then why'd you come to Rehovot? I said, the whole way, I got to ask you questions. Now I'll take a bus back to Jerusalem. So I had 45 minutes alone with a very big Talmid Chacham. I got to ask him, we ended the conversation. He said, we could mail. That was the pre-email days. He said, send me your questions by mail, I'll answer you. So I developed a relationship with the big rabbi because I saw he was going back home. No one was going with him. You know, everyone walked until the car. So how did I get to know Rabbi Avram Shapiro, the chief rabbi of Israel? Same thing. I'd be at weddings where he was officiating the wedding. At the end of the wedding, I'd ask if I could get a ride back. I'd take a ride back to his house, talk to him the whole way, and then get on a bus and go back to the wedding. But I just got... Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, same thing. Rav Mordechai Eliyahu was once at an engagement of a couple that I merited to be their shadchan. So I don't know why he did this. At the engagement, he asked the girl's father, he says, did you pay the shadchan? So the girl's father says, no. So he says, pay the shadchan. Well, the guy got your daughter engaged. So I said, Rabbi, I don't want money. So he said, what do you want? I said, I want your time. He said, what do you mean? I said, I want you to teach him. If you give me time, I don't need his money, I need your time. And then he agreed that I would become a member of a certain class that he gave, that you had to be a part of his yeshiva to join. So I was then given permission to join that class that met with him once a week. Okay? The Torah says, Uledavkabo, you want to connect to Hashem. How do you connect? Find the people that most represent Hashem's Torah in the world and connect to them. And through that, we learn a lot. I could tell you stories the whole night of the lessons that I had the good fortune of learning from being next to extraordinary people. It's the living Torah. In our generation, we're preparing for Rosh Hashanah. How do we learn what it means to be a good person? Read biographies. Don't believe everything it says in the biographies. But the biographies help us. They help us. You don't believe everything, but it still tells you a lot. Doesn't matter. You read about Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, that they closed the door on his hand and he didn't say a word until the driver pulled off and reached the next corner because he didn't want to embarrass the guy who slammed the door on his hand. You get a perspective of what it means to care for a fellow Jew, right? How much can we hold in? You know, if someone takes that piece of schnitzel that we wanted on the plate, we're ready to kill him, right? Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, the guy slammed the door on his hand and he doesn't want to say anything, so the guy shouldn't be embarrassed, right? So the car is driving and his hand is stuck there, and it's only after they're out of earshot that he opens the door to pull it in. Can we understand that? Okay, so whether the story is exaggerated, whether it was his pinky or his hand, the theme still stays. Saying the pinky hurts too. Yes,
no,
hurts more. Okay. I can't imagine it. In all honesty, I can't imagine how a person does that. But you read stories of giants, so that's one of the ways we learn where we should be aspiring to. Tov.